one into the night. Deep into right. Way out of here.
Swung on.
Bit crushed.
And the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch. Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
From WHYY, this is your Friday edition of Hittin' Season, a Philadelphia Phillies podcast. My name is Justin Clue. I write for Baseball Prospectus. I'm the author of Summer of the Cheap Wieners, what the 1941 Phillies were doing while Joe DiMaggio was making history. Available now. With me is Liz Rocher, the editor of Sabres Baseball Research Journal. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin. What a series it was.
What
in
a series.
Toronto.
What a series. They go north of the border and I'll say drama free. For the most part. That's always nice when they're able to do that. In a little bit, we're going to be talking to Steve Drumright of Pitcher List and Brewer Fanatic for a little scouting report on what we can expect from the first place Milwaukee Brewers, whom the Phillies will be facing this weekend at American Family Field. Liz, I don't know why, but do you think there's a more ominously named ballpark in Major League Baseball than American Family Field? I don't know. It just sounds like it's from like a Handmaid's Tale to me.
It does. For some reason. I have to tell you, right when you were starting to talk about the ballpark, I'm like, American Family Field, man, it's still just Miller Park to me. And then you started talking about the name, and I'm like, are we psychic? No, obviously. But it is like a very dystopianly named field. And for me, like, Miller Park is perfect. Like, it was bonkers to me that they just completely, they just stopped, they just ended the naming agreement, and Miller didn't want to continue it. I'm like, Miller Park, it's iconic. It's Milwaukee. It's beer. What are you doing? You're
like
just
Bush
letting
Stadium.
This great advertisement opportunity. Like, there are so few things that are meant to be together.
Mm-hmm.
Those
Absolutely.
Things are meant to be together.
It's a perfect, it's like an example of when branding kind of sort of became a part of baseball a little bit. And you're like, you know, you roll your eyes at it because it's all just a commercial. But at the end of the day, yeah, it's just Miller Park in your head because it just makes too much sense not to be. And, you know, we live in an age when, and this is officially an old man cloud rant, but we live in an age when all the stadiums are being turned into AI or bank names. You know, there's going to be like two banks left and they own all the stadiums at some point. But like, There was just a perfect alignment there of like the city and the team and baseball and beer and like, yeah, it was great. The mascot is Bernie the Brewer, for God's sake. Like the mascot is a beer maker. It just, it makes too much sense. And it's like Busch Stadium where it kind of works in like multiple ways in that A, obviously the Busch family, but also beer and baseball, you get that alignment too. But also like as a kid, I thought it was called Busch Stadium because, oh, Cardinals might like live in a bush. And so like that just connected in my head. And then I realized later that wasn't what it was. But there's still that kind of element at play there. So there's just, yeah, there's these perfectly, and maybe it's just because we grew up with them and it's like the name we know. And now it's different. That's obviously a factor as you get older too. But
well,
end of the day, Miller Park just makes too much sense. Yeah, Heinz Field is another good example. Yeah.
I mean, they ruined that a couple, right before I was laid off from Yahoo. I remember writing about that. Like they the team itself didn't want to continue its agreement with Heinz because it was so below market value. And I'm just like, do you not have enough money? Like, does this association from the city and the team and the history not mean anything to you as the only team, like one of the only teams like that hadn't changed coaches in decades and decades? And, you know, like one of the most old school, like you couldn't find it in your hearts to keep Heinz as your sponsor. Like it's all gross. So we should all call stadiums whatever we want.
this might be kind of a leap, and we are going to get to the Phillies and Blue Jays series finale up in Toronto before they hit the road on Thursday for a travel day and then arrived in Milwaukee today on Friday to play a game tonight at 7:40. We're going to talk about a trade the Phillies made as well. But because you got me thinking about it, you know, in the same way that we're saying, like, oh, yeah, this stadium was called this for a long time. And because of that, it's forever going to be that. There's just a general shift in, like, it feels like names are bought and sold, and players are bought and sold a lot more, with a lot more frequency. Like back, you know, years ago, it would have been like, oh, a player signed a deal and stayed with a team for a really long time, and now we've entered a phase where, you know, whereas a stadium name might change, you also have like players are also changing the longevity of staying with a team, and that like somebody like Bo Bichette would rather take short-term deals to re-enter free agency, which makes sense. That's good for the player. But Liz, as somebody who's definitely got a mind and a background in these labor issues that are definitely about to become the forefront of the sport, do you see like elegance or honor that is always pointed out when a player stays with one team for a long time, or because of how much more money they can make re-entering free agency? Is that something that is like, no, this is a positive development for the players?
I think it's about perception. And so I think it's perceived as, you know, like an honorable old school thing to stay with the team, you know, your entire career. But it always just depends on like the individual player. Like there's no law. Like I know that like baseball is not a monolith, but the prevailing mindset was team, you know, players who leave are betrayers. And I'm glad we finally moved away from that. And we're sort of looking at players like, you can do whatever you want. Like, the team that you leave will be angry at you, but you will not be marked as a betrayer among all baseball players, you know, in all of MLB, and people will not look upon you with, you know, fondly. I think, you know, I'm glad we're past that. And we're sort of in an age where players can feel free to do what they'd like. We mentioned Jose Ramirez not too long ago, and like, he's an incredible player who could have gotten more money with another team, but he's stayed with Cleveland his entire career because he likes it there. He doesn't want to go anywhere. He's comfortable. So why
leave? By his own admission.
Yeah. He's like, I like it here. Why should I go? It is my life. I could do whatever I want with it. And I think while the Players Association would certainly prefer players to seek out, you know, and sign like the most beneficial contracts that would rise, you know, a rising tide raises all boats, that would help rise the tide for everybody. I think the point of a union is for the worker to have power. And if what they want to do is stay with one team their whole career, regardless of what they're offered, then, you know, the union rules allow them to do that. And so I think the union would certainly rather him do something different, but I think they're happy with him being able to do what he wants to do, because that's the point in all this.
Well, we started with the time and place of tonight's Phillies Brewers game and ended up working out some labor questions that I think are going to be what we're talking about in the months ahead. But that popped into my mind because, you know, this is an age where things are just a lot more, things change hands and are a lot more fluid. And, you know, there's a lot less longevity, I feel like, in general, but in like sports and in baseball. We have certainly seen the multiple cases of that in the examples we're giving here. But regardless, the Phillies did finish up a series up in Toronto this week, and we can talk about that now. The Phillies and Jays had split the first two games, and Jesus Luzardo got the ball in Game 3 on Wednesday, Liz, at the site of his undoing last year, where it was determined he was tipping pitches. Jesus Luzardo struck out 8 and walked 4 Blue Jays through 5 and 2/3 innings in the finale of the Phillies' 3-game set in Toronto. So, generally a recovery, Liz. I feel like there was some weight being put on this because of what happened a year ago and because of Lizardo's up-and-down season. If you'll recall, when he got blown up earlier this year, we talked about it on the show, but he immediately, before even being asked, was like, I wasn't tipping my pitches, because you have heard time and time again about the tireless, long-into-the-night efforts that the coaching staff went into with him about not tipping his pitches anymore and really working on that. So, largely, if you have questions about Jesus Luzardo, you saw kind of a funny quote about it. Cole Weintraub of NBC Sports Philly notes that Luzardo now has a 1.55 ERA and 7 road starts. This is an interesting quirk to his output this year. At home, the Southpaw has a 7.34 ERA. That is a 5.79 run gap between his home and road ERAs, which leads all pitchers in 2026, with Logan Gilbert next at 4.56. It would also be the third largest gap by a left-hander since those splits began being tracked in 1976 with a minimum of 10 total starts. Lizardo does not have a clear explanation for it. This is going to be an ongoing theme, I'm now realizing, in this episode.
It already has been.
Present a problem.
They seemingly have no explanation for it. Could have been placed at the end of almost every podcast title that we've had this entire season.
Yeah, you want explanations? Well, and then the Phillies just walk away. Like, that's generally how that gets addressed at this point in time.
Over a whiteboard and it's empty. There you go.
And what does that mean? He flips it over. It just says, "We do not know." All right, meeting adjourned.
Good meeting.
Good meeting. Let's get out there and win another game because we're playing really well. The Phillies faced a returning Max Scherzer for the Blue Jays. Another fun little injection into this series. If you judged his output on how he looked before the game, doing his typical Max Scherzer sitting in the dugout, maybe rocking back and forth a little bit, remember that he has two different colored eyeballs, you know, you might have thought, right, even at like 42 years old, this guy could come out here and just buzzsaw through this lineup if he felt like it. But the 42 year oldness of Max Scherzer
like
was on display once he started pitching. Bryce Harper and Alec Bohm both homered off Max Scherzer. Kyle Schwarber homered off reliever Mason Fluharty. Harper also had a double, and Bryson Stott had a two-hit day as well. So it was good news for the Phillies. They built a comfortable lead. They did what is new and totally welcome and had that 6-0 lead in place by the fourth inning in this one, giving Jesus Luzardo the cushion he needed to walk as many Blue Jays as his heart desired. Fortunately, no real trouble surfaced until the bottom of the seventh when Phil's reliever, Chase Shugart, decided to walk everybody in town.
What is he doing? I'm just like sitting there like, there's a difference between a lead you can't get past and that. What are you doing? You don't have that much breathing room, man. Find the strike zone.
If they had the nerve, they would have changed the little green walk signs in Toronto to Chase Shugart's face after this. I mean, if you were in Toronto on Wednesday, you might have been walked by Chase Shugart.
You probably were.
It wasn't even like a historic amount of walks, but when you're sitting there watching it happen where he walks a guy and walks a guy and walks a guy and then walks in a run because of how many people he's walking, you know, he allowed a hit, three walks, and three runs, which again, isn't the worst third of an inning of all time. Might be close, but it's not. It's just you're sitting there watching it happen, and it's brutal, especially when the Phillies have a lead and you're kind of watching it disappear through what feel like avoidable circumstances. Fortunately, a couple of sack flies trimmed the Phillies' lead to 7-4 and led to an injury to Adolis Garcia in right when he made a throw home from the outfield with the fire of 1,000 suns.
Yeah.
More on that in a minute. Oh. But in general, Liz, did you feel like the Blue Jays were closing in? Did you feel like because of the trouble that was happening, it wasn't even like the Blue Jays were rallying. It was sort of like the Phillies were wilting. Did you feel like this lead
was
actually
opening the door and
saying,
come on in? It felt like it was about to get out of control. If they had not stopped it where they did, it would not have stopped. That's the thing. They had to put a stop to it when they did, because if they got any closer, I'm like, I'll be turning the game off and I'll turn it back on and there'll be 13 runs. There'll be 13 runs on the board somehow and the Phillies will be losing.
Yeah, I realize we do that because it feels like you're resetting your laptop. Like your computer has a problem that you can't solve. Yes. And you're just like, I guess I should just turn it off and turn it on and maybe it'll be different. But because it's a live baseball game, that doesn't really happen. And yet here we are talking about how that's definitely what we are assuming with our brains is happening when we turn the TV off.
Turn it off, walk away for a little while, you come back, you've done literally nothing but allow minutes to pass while you walk around your own house. You come back and you turn on, like, why is everything the same but also worse?
I don't understand how this could happen except for it continued while I wasn't watching because they didn't stop playing.
Damn.
Well, the Phillies didn't do any more scoring, but they did bring in Joan Duran for his second straight day of work with the score now 7-4, allowing the hopefully all-star closer to come back from his first blown save of the season on Tuesday. He nailed it down with little trouble this time, thanks in part to JT Realmuto's game-ending ABS challenge. Liz, are you looking forward to more game-ending automatic ball strike system challenges? I feel like when that happens to you, it's going to be infuriating, which I believe it's happened to the Phillies. And when you do it to someone else, it's, I would say, not as satisfying as it is infuriating when you are on the other side of it.
Yeah. It's like, oh, that's great. Like, it's... I don't know if we've seen, like, a walk-off ABS yet, like, for someone that would be walking in a run, and that ended the game. Like, I think that would be
in the playoffs.
Oh, the chaos.
That's what I was imagining when they were like, we're using this system. My first thought went to, when that ends a playoff game, it's going to be, yeah, chaos is the other word. It's going to be very intense, let's say. The energy will not be great.
Cities will burn.
Yeah.
So or maybe not. That might be too intense.
But that's JT Realmuto doing what we kept saying he is going to be so good at. And I think for the most part, he has been largely good at it. Harper doesn't feel like he's great at using it, I gotta say. I feel like a lot of his challenges aren't really challenges. But Realmuto, yeah, this was another example of him knowing what he saw, and it totally worked. Phillies won another series. And Liz, they are 28-12 in their first 40 games under Don Mattingly. They are 2.5 games ahead of the Nationals in third, 8 games behind the Braves for the National League East lead. The Mets continue to be in last place. If the season ended today, Elizabeth, the Phillies would have the second wild card spot. Feels a little different than you know, maybe when we're watching them lose 10 games in a row. I want you to guess, though, because it's been a weird kind of year. I think teams are starting to separate. I think you're starting to see some separation in the pack. But for about 2 months there, it was sort of like there were 2-3 dominant teams. And then almost everyone else from teams that were supposed to be good and teams that were supposed to be bad were hovering like 1-5 games over or under 500. Everybody was just kind of like around those marks. And
in a big clump.
Yeah, there were a couple outliers. But you know, the whole point is not a lot. Not a lot of outliers from that group. Things are shifting, certainly, but there's still a question of kind of like, who is really good? Like, are the White Sox actually scrappy enough to, like, make their way in? Are the A's actually, like, is their offense, potent enough to really make some noise? I was filling out my All-Star ballot yesterday, Liz, and there were a bunch of A's on it, which really surprised me.
Wild.
So people are,
they don't even enter my mind.
Yeah. But the numbers are there, man. And then you're like, yeah, right, Shea Langeliers is having a good time. You know, I can't even remember their names. I was like, why'd I go down this road? This is the whole point. I was like, oh, yeah, look at these A's going off. But in any case, things are shifting a little bit. And the Phillies are one of those things that is shifting. They kind of proved that early season funk they were in was not their true definition, I think you can say by now, no matter what it took to get here. You know, these guys are the real Phillies. They've played well long enough to say that this is the real version of them, not the version that lost 10 games in a row. But now that they're in this second wildcard spot, I wanted to ask you, Liz, who do you think are the other two National League teams in wildcard spots right now, other than the Phillies? Because it kind of surprised me, but I'll see if it surprises you.
All right. I'm not looking at it.
Don't look at
it. I haven't looked at that. I was about to open the standings before you started talking about this.
Before
you started talking about this. And then you started talking about teams and records. And like, I think he's going to ask me a question. So I stopped. I have absolutely no information. Surprising teams. One of them, the Cardinals.
Yes, the Cardinals, which honestly shouldn't be, I guess it shouldn't be that surprising, but they weren't supposed to be good this year. They were actually supposed to be pretty bad. And the fact that they're 37-29 means they're better than the Phillies record-wise, and they have a 2.5 game lead on the Phillies in the wild card. They're the top wild card team. They've just been playing well, you know? They have winning records at home and on the road. I know Jordan Walker's been making noise. Alec Burleson's been making noise. But yeah, Cardinals are one of the wild card teams out of the Central, which could change. You know, there's other competitive Central teams. The two teams nipping at the heels of the team in the third spot are also from the NL Central, which probably helps you with your second answer here. Who do you think is in the third wild card spot in the National League?
Well, I kind of, is it, no, it's not. Do I remember all the teams in the AM Central? I do.
it's tough.
Is it the Cubs?
It's not the Cubs. The Cubs are 35-34. They are right with the Pirates for trying to get into this third wild card spot. They're not. They're a game out. So, like, again, like I said, they are willing to be annoying. But yeah, there is another team.
And you can talk about it now because now I can't remember who the other team the NL Central is.
Well, it's not an NL Central team, if that helps.
I thought you said NL Central. Sorry.
No, I said there were two NL Central teams nipping at the heels of the team in the third spot.
Oh, okay. Is it... I mean, the Phillies just swept the Padres, like, twice, right? Or almost, and...
They completed a season sweep of the Padres, yes.
It doesn't feel like it's them. Is it the Nationals?
That also feels wrong. That would be shocking. The Nationals are actually the team behind the Cubs.
You're right.
They are also 35-34. Like, they are right there with the Cubs and Pirates trying to get in. Liz, it is the Padres, which kind of blew my mind because I thought they are, I guess, flip-flopping with the Diamondbacks for second place behind the Dodgers in the NL West. And currently, since the Phillies left them, they've managed to, well, win a game. So, and this is what blew my mind, because they've famously had a worse offense than the Phillies, who had a famously pretty weak offense until very recently. The Padres have lost 7 of their last 10. And like you just pointed out, they got season swept by the Phillies in like 3 weeks. They were swept twice by the Phillies. Like, it's just, it was not who I would have guessed was in a playoff spot at the moment. But hey, they got more wins than losses. They are 35-32, and they're playing the Orioles, who are a very beatable team one way or another. Yeah. So, you know, hey, that caught me off guard. I did not think the Padres would be the third team in the playoff spot right now. Who knows?
Same here.
Yeah. Well, in general, after this game and after another series win, I feel like the Phillies are in a good, perhaps precarious spot, given that one shove in any direction will lead to a stumble, because this team doesn't have all of its legs to stand on most of the time, it feels like. Case in point, I don't know if you saw the breaking news, but the Phillies made a deal this week. They actually completed a trade, according to Jeff Passan at ESPN. The Phillies acquired 30-year-old center fielder Derek Hill and $250,000. I always wonder, when it's a player and money, do they like buy two seats on the plane and it's a player sitting next to a pile of money, and then they like put sunglasses on the money so that the stewardess knows that he's asleep and doesn't want to be bothered. Anyway, $250,000 from the White Sox for a pair of minor leaguers, outfielder Dylan Campbell and infielder Jose Colmenares. Hill was claimed off waivers by the White Sox last September, and he's hitting as well as a guy who was claimed off waivers last September typically would be. 213, 4 homers, 8 RBI in 50 games this year. He's been in the league since 2020, playing for the Tigers, Nationals, Giants, Rangers, Marlins, and White Sox. This is not an answer, Derek Hill. It is a response. It is a response to Adolis Garcia making a throw so hard from right field that he pulled a muscle in his right shoulder in Wednesday's finale against the Blue Jays in Toronto. If only the runner had been out. It could have been an out. Just, you know, the bounce goes the other way, the catcher's in the right, but, you know, it was a crazy throw. So the Phillies had to designate.
That's why I love him so much. He tries so hard. He wants to be good. He likes being on the Phillies. This is why I like him. And now I'm so sad because it was just eaten up.
I don't think. Yeah, that's the roughest part, is that he was finally starting to like hit home runs a little more consistently. And obviously he's got that arm, but I don't think he's lost. You know, I think this is recoverable. I just hope, like you're saying, I hope he can come back and refine the swing that was starting to work for him. The Phillies also designated right-hander Jackson Rutledge for assignment in order to make room for Derek Hill. This is all very normal. You know, this is some of those like little deals that teams make throughout the season just because. But it's also inescapably indicative of the Phillies. You know, you remove a starter from this lineup, which you look up top to the bottom of the lineup, you're like, oh, this is pretty good. This team should be able to hit enough. You know, Schwarber, Harper, you get a breakout year from Marsh. you know, somebody else starts also hitting, which we have seen, you know, Bohm has been, you know, he wasn't hitting and then he was for a little and then he wasn't again. And now he's heating up, you know, he's doing a little, hitting a little more. You know, you're seeing enough offense right now. They've scored more than like five runs a couple of times recently to really try and dispel that narrative. But you take a one starter out of like a lineup or even the rotation and, you know, Dave Dombrowski's scrambling to acquire a rando outfielder from the White Sox because once again, whoops, the Phillies just like don't have a guy they need. Liz, are there just not enough baseball players in general anymore? Like, why does this always seem to be the case? Every time you say the Phillies need a guy to do this, but, you know, the caveat is always, but unfortunately that guy's not around. Why did this team go into the season hoping that they just wouldn't need options outside of their starting lineup?
I don't know. A lot of teams, when this type of thing happens, they pull from their minor league system, you know? And the Phillies just don't do that, mostly because they can't. So I don't know. They had to know they were going to get bad luck with injuries at some point. Like, with I am annoyed that they didn't have, like, a plan, because part of it is that they're so set on their bench. They love a lot of the guys that they have.
And so it's not it's not a deep bench. Like, exactly. Famously, this year, it has not been a great bench.
No, it leaves them bereft of options anytime anything happens that is not exactly what's supposed to happen. So, yeah, like, they like Edmundo Sosa a lot, and he's got limitations. You know, they want to... You know, they liked Otto Kemp a lot, and he's not good. And the guy whose name I can't remember.
Felix Reyes.
Felix Reyes. He came up and was also not good. And, like, now they're really super out of options, so they had to go somewhere else. Like, part of it is that, I mean, a lot of it is they just don't have good internal options either. It's not even, like, their bench is shallow, but also their minor league, their Triple A team is shallow.
Of the seven guys who qualify as, like, making up at some point the Phillies bench this season, the highest batting average is .202, and it belongs to Edmundo Sosa, who also has the highest OPS at .569. Now, hey,
Justin, look, that's so bad.
Look, a bench player's job is not easy, and it's made even more difficult by the inconsistency of your play. In a Rob Thompson world where you are more aware probably than in any other locker room of when exactly your playing time is going to be. And obviously this isn't a Rob Thompson locker room anymore anyway. But even in that case, it's still, you know, it can be sporadic. You never know when a guy's going to get hurt. I totally grant them the grace of that, a bench player in general. But boy, these are very low numbers, and they feel even lower when you consider, you mentioned how much the team loved Otto Kemp. They were really pitching Otto Kemp. Like, they went out of their way to be like, Otto Kemp, anyone? And like, trying to play up the, well, you know, is it running it back if players that were not as good are better now, even though they're the same players? And what even is running it back? And here's the percentage of our roster that's changed, so you can't even say we're running it back. And also, we brought Schwarber back, which, again, isn't running it back. And you just wind up in this position where you're like, okay, Adolis Garcia pulled a muscle, and now we got to go find a guy because he's not. We can't find a .213 hitting center fielder in our system. We had to go get him. And it's interesting you mentioned, like, go to the minors and find answers, because Matt Gelb noted that the weak hitting Derek Hill could just be put in a platoon with perhaps outfield prospect Gabriel Rincones Jr., who also hasn't been hitting very well this year, and he missed 6 weeks due to knee inflammation. But, you know, a right fielder goes down and we're scrapping one together out of 30-year-old journeyman and recovering knee injury prospect. Not the best development, regardless of how much I'd love to see Gabriel Rincones Jr. playing in the major leagues. As Gelb puts it, referring to Derek Hill, he would, at the very least, be a different option for the outfield mix. Oh, no, I'm sorry. He's referring to Rincones Jr. there. And, like, that's like as much as you can say about it. At the very least, it's different, I guess, and maybe something clicks for this guy that didn't click for, I don't know, Garcia. But it's not like Garcia's not going to get a shot when he comes back. But then again, this team's so short on functioning outfielders that it's pretty much Brandon Marsh And then some other stuff, like Adolis Garcia, who you want to see stay or perhaps even get more productive. Justin Crawford, who's, you know, rookie figuring things out and not super hitting the ball. And then what? Otto Kemp, Felix Reyes, Edmundo Sosa. Those guys I just mentioned are all also infielders.
Yeah.
Stuart Baroa, a fill-in quad A guy who has actually been with the team for like a couple of days now. And Brian De La Cruz, who made everybody think the Phillies had a viable outfield backup option at AAA after his terrific spring and has since hit very poorly for the Iron Pigs up in Allentown since the start of the regular season. Oh, yes. Don't forget Garrett Stubbs, the outfield experiment never technically ended. So there's another throw a fourth infielder into the mix as far as the Phillies outfield depth goes. There's a certain amount of these things happen. That's a part of every season. But I can't shake the feeling that the Phillies feel like they just didn't do their homework over the winter and then rolled into the exam on opening day, hoping their quick scan of the Cliff Notes in the parking lot would be enough to get them through.
That's how I got into college. But
I mean, look, we've all been there. Let's not cast stones here. But I'm just saying, I'm into their success
lately.
We weren't
running a baseball team.
We're seeing how a team set up like the Phillies, even with its flaws, can still win games. Like I said, 28-12 under Don Mattingly. Phillies look great lately. Obviously, there's areas to improve. But all it took was a pulled muscle for them to have to go out of the organization for an answer. It's June, Liz. We're a lot of pulled muscles from October. Is this concerning?
Yeah. I'd say it is. They have no options for that. They don't have options for anybody. Like, what are their options for anybody else? Like, the outfield has been the issue because it's been unsettled because guys have continued to be bad. But, like, if something else happens, they are well and truly screwed. Like, they'll have to try and keep winning in spite of what happens instead of they're winning because of everyone being here and good. Mm-hmm. It turns into just a different mission entirely. Like this outfield stuff, like while losing Garcia is annoying and frustrating, it's, you know, to replace him isn't going to be hard. It'll be a little, you know, maybe a little less on the hitting department, maybe a home run or two less, but it's not like they're trying to replace a 300 hitter. If they have to replace someone who's hitting, let's say, above 250, I mean, all I hear is the sad trombone in my head. That's all I'm hearing when I think of what happens there.
Yeah. I don't want to freak out. I don't want to seem like, you know, I'm totally freaking out about it.
We're just being realistic.
And it is, you know, and let's imagine a situation where Derek Hill gets into some games and does a couple of things. Like has a, I can't remember his name. That guy who had that terrific weekend coming up from the minors, made the game-saving catch against the Mets going over the wall.
Raleigh?
Stevenson. Wow, you were close because his name was Cal. Wow.
I knew it
great
was a
call.
Cal. I'm like, Cal Raleigh? No, that's a completely different dude.
Yeah.
I know who you're talking about. It's not him.
Maybe Derek Hill pops up and has like a Cal Stevenson weekend. And it's like, oh, this is great. And then, hey, great job, Dave Dombrowski. You know, you didn't have the guy you needed, but you went out and found one using your president of baseball ops prowess. And you found an answer and it totally worked out. Probably better than you thought it would. So, you know, there's always that scenario. So you don't want to make too much out of it. But it just feels like that's what we keep running into is that this team, you know, they'll say the Derek Hill signing adds to their depth, but then they'll also be like the Phillies lack depth because of what we have discussed in the past, that depth shouldn't really count as depth unless it's a player who can like contribute, you know, like if you're replacing even Adolis Garcia with a guy who's going to like go 0-for-6 with 4 strikeouts, then that's not really depth. That's just another guy. So that's what the Phillies are missing and everybody knows it. And Dave Dombrowski knows it. And it's just when you got to go out and make a deal like this, it's just like, man, I guess there's no difference between doing this and that guy already being here. But in a way there is, you know, in a way feels like I said, you didn't get it done over the winter. So now it's got to get done now. And this won't be the last time I feel like the Phillies got to do this.
And it wasn't the first. They did this last season.
Yep. And honestly, like bringing up Felix Reyes was like, oh, what are we doing here? Like
I know.
This guy. And then he hit a home run in his first at bat. And it was like, oh, okay, everybody's a genius and this is great. So
are those we have learned, I think, as a fan base to cherish those moments. Mm-hmm. We understand that things, good things like that don't happen all the time, especially to us. And so when that happens, we could cherish it, though we still have not accomplished the maybe don't expect so much after that part of the whole equation.
Well, maybe Derek Hill will make an impact this very weekend. Who knows? Probably not. Quick note, the Phillies will face the Brewers' young phenom Jacob Mizorowski in Game 1 on Friday. The hope was that he and Christopher Sanchez would face off in a pitcher's duel for the ages, but he'll be going up against Andrew Painter tonight at 7:40. This is a note from Jason Stark I wanted to share. Miz and Sanchez, with 116 and 113 strikeouts, respectively, are also the only two pitchers in their league with 100 strikeouts or more. And Stats tells us this will be the first series since 1913 in which two of the starting pitchers ranked 1 and 2 in the major leagues in strikeouts and entered with ERAs under 155. That's also with a minimum of 5 starts. The point is, there will be two of the best pitchers in the National League in this series as Sanchez gets the ball in Game 3. It is a shame that they won't be facing each other, Liz, but boy, oh boy. These are just two really good pitchers. And I did some research on just looking back on Sanchez's baseball past for a story that's up on Baseball Prospectus right now that tries to parallel Grover Cleveland Alexander and Christopher Sanchez's scoreless streaks, and then obviously how they intersect at the end with Sanchez breaking Alexander's record. But in doing so, you look back and Liz, it was 2022 when the Phillies were like, well, we got to bump someone off the roster for this move, and it's either going to be Christopher Sanchez or Nick Nelson, and Nick Nelson is a better long reliever than Christopher Sanchez. 2022. And now he's here. being a part of not only setting franchise records, but also like third place in scoreless inning streaks in all of baseball history, and also being mentioned as part of a record that's a first since 1913. I mean, again, I will never not be staggered by the progress and change in Christopher Sanchez's status in this organization and in baseball in general. It is truly unbelievable.
It's one of the Phillies' best stories, I think, maybe in franchise history. If I'm gonna be so bold.
As far as like a franchise, we're always dinging for not having success stories like this. And yeah, he was acquired via trade, but he also, to an extent, is a product of the Phillies farm system as well. He spent plenty of time within it, despite not starting in it. And it's staggering. And you're right. I think it'll go down as one of the biggest success stories. Christopher Sanchez is probably the success story the Phillies thought Aaron Nola was going to be. Wow. Mm. What a sad insight. Hey, coming up next, Steve Drumwright gives us a little insight into what expect from the Brewers this weekend. But hey, no matter what happens, you're going to be seeing Andrew Painter get the ball at 7:40 p.m. tonight at American Family Field in Milwaukee, taking on, yes, that top strikeout leader in the National League, Jacob Mizorowski. Should be a fun matchup. Then on Saturday at 7:10 p.m., you get Aaron Nola taking on Shane Drouin of the Brewers. Drouin, another left-hander. You're going to see the Phillies face in this series, unfortunately, because they'll get another one in Game 3 in Kyle Harrison, who is having a great year for Milwaukee, and he will be taking on the Phillies' own left-hander, Christopher Sanchez, for the Sunday matinee. Liz, you have any further thoughts on this series before we wrap up?
No, I hope it's going to be a good one. I want it to be, you know, either what the Phillies to annihilate them, or I want it to be really competitive. The Brewers are a good team. They always put up a good fight. It would be nice to kick the crap out of them.
You know, the last time the Phillies were playing well, I was eager to see them go up against the Dodgers, you know, take on some of the National League's truly serious competition, and that was bad. So this is great. This is another go at it. They're playing well again, and now they're going to take on another team that's first place in their division in the National League, and I think it'll be a fun little experiment, but I have no reason why I would assume that based on the results last time. It will be an appropriate matchup, and I eagerly await the results. Let's go with that. The Phillies road trip continues this weekend from Toronto to Milwaukee to face the Brewers, who yet again lead the NL Central with a combination of pitching and hitting at the same time, too. That's the real key, as we've learned with the Phillies. Joining me now to talk about the Brewers' success and this weekend's matchup with the Phillies is Steve Drumwright, a writer for Pitcher List and Brewer Fanatic. You can follow him on Blue Sky at Drummer Writes. Steve, thanks for joining us on Hittin' Season.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Justin. Appreciate the invite.
Like the Phillies with the Brewers, it's not really the pitching you really got to worry about. The Athletic just read, Jacob Mizorowski and Kyle Harrison are tearing through lineups like tissue paper, combining for a 14-3 record with 193 strikeouts thus far. Harrison got shelled Monday against the Athletics, but before that, the Brewers were the first team in more than 100 years to have a pair of pitchers with ERAs under 2 who both average 11 or more strikeouts per 9 innings through 10 starts. It sounds like a lot of qualifiers, but you're just piling impressive stuff on top of each other. The Phillies are scheduled to see both of these guys over the weekend. Not exactly the best news, even for this offense like the Phillies have, that's reached something of a rolling boil at the moment. Not that you'd want to tell us, but with the Phillies facing Mizorowski in Game 1 on Friday, are there any weaknesses in his game for them to exploit, or is this 24-year-old string bean just firing on all cylinders?
Well, I will say this, is he hasn't had a bad outing yet this year. So, you know, there's always, you know, one of those in the back pocket somewhere that's going to pop its head up. It's an interesting anniversary for Mizorowski as well, too, because Friday is the 1-year anniversary of when he made his MLB debut. So, and that was with 5 hitless innings. He actually had in between his first 2 starts, he actually had a 9-inning no-hitter between the two. But, you know, he splashed onto the scene 1 year ago today, and to see where he's come from then to the end of the season to now is really remarkable.
Yeah, I wish there was a Sanchez-Mizorowski matchup on the slate just to work that out after that caused
that. That would have been really cool. That would have been really cool, you know, especially considering what happened in May, you know, with the battle between them. Sanchez was clearly the choice there, you know, for pitcher of the month. You know, but, you know, it was really remarkable to see both of those guys put up the numbers they did in the same month.
Absolutely. Well, the scheduled Game 2 starter is 27-year-old rookie Shane Drouin. He's here with the Brewers due to a plague of injuries that really swept through this Milwaukee pitching staff, including injuries to starters Brandon Woodruff, Quinn Priester, and Logan Henderson. And yet, Drouin has performed admirably. As Brewers manager Pat Murphy put it, "I think we got very, very lucky." Honestly, he's the kind of guy that the Phillies would love to be able to reach for when they need him and have him, but they don't have a lot of guys like that. Drouin had a 5-pitch mix in the minors for a while, but struggled with locating everything, and his velo wasn't really catching a lot of eyes. But it was the Brewers who had him spread out his targets rather than live on one side of the plate, narrow his pitch selection, focus more on quality than quantity. They also revamped his motion, had him develop a sinker this past spring. He's a work in progress still. I think they're still trying to give him a changeup or work out how to throw his changeup. But the 3.11 ERA and the 37 strikeouts with only 11 walks and 37 2/3 innings is, I mean, completely acceptable as far as the role he's filling. They used to call Drouin a long reliever, and they might be calling him something else now. What is Drouin's future like in the majors, in your view? Does he have a big role in this team moving forward?
I think moving forward he will. It's going to depend on injuries. You know, I think they did see him as more of a long reliever entering the year, and he's had to jump into the rotation his past few outings. But he was one of the 3 players that the Brewers got in the Caleb Durbin trade, which you just sit for a minute and take a look at the 3 names that they got for that. It was Kyle Harrison, Shane Drouin, and David Hamilton, and the 3 players that they gave up, which were Caleb Durbin and 2 4A infielders. You know, it's remarkable to see that the Red Sox gave up that much for Durbin, but the Brewers have done their homework on him, and he was kind of, you know, maybe lost a little bit in the shuffle with the Red Sox, and the Brewers are always looking for, you know, missed opportunities from other teams. You know, that's how they got Quinn Priester last year, and look what happened with Priester last year. You know, unfortunately, he's hurt this year, but, you know, Drouin, you know, a lefty. You know, he did pretty well in his last few starts. He definitely is going to be a part of the future in the rotation, if not the rest of this year, at least, you know, it's going forward next year.
Yeah, the Brewers seem to have a distinctly more, I'll say, visible result in trying to find guys that other teams let go and let that like slip through the cracks. They're not the only team trying to do that, but they do it well. And then once guys get here, they have a development team as well on the pitching side, at least that's really been formative reputationally. And this sounds like they put some work in to Drouin to get him where he is now.
Yeah, I mean, the Red Sox are usually pretty good at developing pitchers as well. But I think the one thing that the Brewers do extremely well is that they find out what your strengths are, what you like to do, and ride with that. You know, there's some other teams that force pitches onto pitchers, you know, oh no, you must throw the slider here, you know, and stuff like that. The Brewers want you to benefit from what you do well and what you're comfortable with doing. And that's, I think that's the one of the secret sauces in their development for pitchers.
Yeah, I feel like it was Gabe Kapler, I think, with the Phillies, where they were commanded to throw high fastballs. And then you had these guys like Zach Eflin who were like, I throw sinkers, and they're trying to throw high fastballs, and it just
exactly
wasn't working.
Yeah. Because then you put pitchers in uncomfortable positions, and you know they're not confident throwing the pitch that the team wants them to throw in a 3-2 count. And ball four or worse.
Yep. Well, Milwaukee also traded some of their left side of their infield options over the winter, leaving the cupboard a little bare. They signed Luis Renjifo to play third and hopefully hit 15 homers on a bounce back deal, but it hasn't really come to fruition. Meanwhile, their minor league system seems to be, you know, healthy with infield options. Brewers fans are eager to see top prospect Cooper Pratt get his shot in the majors, especially after the Brewers locked him up with that 8-year deal back in April. How soon will fans have that wish granted? What impact are you expecting him to make when he joins the team?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, I mean, Renjifo has definitely been a disappointment offensively. David Hamilton has actually taken over a lot of the action at third base, you know, but Hamilton also slides over to shortstop to spell Joey Ortiz. So Hamilton's getting a lot more playing time than I think people expected going into the season, and mainly because of the offensive struggles of those other two. But, you know, I think they're going to ride with Renjifo and Ortiz, you know, on the left side of the infield until it really starts to impact their winning percentage. You know, I mean, Pratt's a defensive ready major league player, right? He has been for the last couple of years. That's always been his forte. You know, it's been his offense that's been the question mark with him, and he's doing fairly well this year. You know, he had a little bit of a slow start, as did Jett Williams, who would be another option. Jett Williams was the prospect that they got from the Mets in a Freddie Peralta deal, along with Brandon Sproat, who won't be pitching this weekend. He pitched last night in Vegas, but you know, they're going to wait on Pratt, you know, and even Luis Lara, the other prospect that they just signed this week, to a contract. You know, they're going to wait until they really need them.
It's nice to have the luxury to be able to do that. if a guy like that, he'd be up right now.
Yeah, and again, I think it's, you know, just circumstances. You know, the Brewers generally aren't one to panic. You know, I mean, they build their team around chemistry, and, you know, and you know, prospects, and, you know, the chemistry with the team is good. You know, it's been good under Pat Murphy. It was good under Craig Counsell, you know, but Murphy just has taken that maybe to a different level. You know, they're going to wait to not spoil that chemistry. I mean, we saw a couple years ago when they traded Josh Hader at the trade deadline, it really affected the clubhouse and it took him down and they missed the playoffs one game. That's the one season, I think, in the last seven that they haven't made the playoffs.
It's encouraging to see a team recognize that being an issue and actually acknowledging, you know, correcting that mistake moving forward. Because, yeah, so teams get a little careless in that regard.
Yeah, and I think that's why you've seen the trades in the offseason. One of the factors in the trades in the offseason for Peralta and Corbin Burns. You know, they let Willy Adames leave. You know, he and Christian Yelich have been the main instigators being the wrong word, but main reasons why they have a really good clubhouse. You know, Adames really brought the Latin players together. You know, he taught Freddie Peralta, William Contreras, and, you know, taught some of the work ethic they needed to be an everyday major league player. Dustin Trio as well.
Yeah, speaking of those guys, this offense has been hitting well lately, been right there with the pitching. Andrew Vaughn, who went 4-for-6 against the A's in one game. Jackson Churio, who just broke a camera with a home run. Christian Yelich, who has 7 hits in his last 4 games. William Contreras hit a 463-foot homer in extras. Jake Bowers is in the middle of a breakout season. I mean, take your pick. Facing a struggling Andrew Painter, a chaotic Aaron Nola, and then, you know, an NL Cy Young candidate in Christopher Sanchez, which of the Brewers' hot hitters do you expect to have a big weekend against the Phillies?
Well, they are coming off of 6 games in altitude. You know, they played 3 games in Coors Field against the Rockies before going to Vegas and whatever you want to call that. It was fun to watch the Vegas games, especially that first game. You know, as you know, people who maybe don't understand the circumstances, you know, I mean, it was basically a PR trip for the A's this week in Vegas, you know, and there was going to be some problems in there, you know, and a 15-14 game in 11 innings was the perfect remedy to that. If you weren't entertained by that, you know, sorry, but you know, I enjoyed it, you know, even as I saw, you know, the A's going, you know, making a comeback on the Brewers, you know, but it was entertaining at the least, you know, and it won't be like that in Vegas moving forward because they're going to be indoors. But, you know, if I'm looking for a breakout, you know, I mean, Jake Bowers has been the breakout candidate this year. You know, he's 2 years ago, he was non-tendered at the arbitration deadline to offer contracts. And then he stuck with the Brewers on a minor league deal first, I believe it was. And then, now he, at the end of last year, he started to come on as offensively. And I think he just said, like, I'm just not going to worry about it. I'm just going to go out there and hit. And so he became a key part of the team's offense down the stretch last year. And he's just continued that this year. He leads a team with 14 home runs. He leads a team in RBIs, you know, with 12 home runs for Bowers. You know, he's just become, you know, one of the fixtures of the offense, you know, and he's kind of pigeonholed between first base and left field, you know, and, you know, they work and with Christian Yelich at DH, you know, so that means, you know, he and Andrew Vaughn split time at first, and then Bowers goes out in the left field every once in a while, moving Churio up over to center.
I should know this, and I know that the series is in Milwaukee and not Philly, but he historically crushes the Phillies or he crushes at Citizens Bank Park. It's like one of the two.
yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean, he's got, I think it's 2 cycles. I want to say it might be a third, but both the cycles are against the Reds. And, okay. You know, but, you know, his numbers against the Phillies, I'm not sure of.
Fair enough. I have plenty of scarring memories of individual players. Ryan Braun, I know for sure, was definitely in that category. I was at that game where he had 3 homers. That was terrible. you brought up Las Vegas. Last question for you. During that Brewers game against the A's in Las Vegas, one of them, the umpire announced that the ABS system was just not working and would not be available. And if we just assume that was a lie, do you expect more umpires to try that little trick in the future? Or did this umpiring crew kind of use up the one chance a crew had to use that excuse?
Well, you know, whatever happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, you know? So, you know, I think it was their one chance, you know, because it's a park that doesn't normally have it. And it did seem to go out a couple times. Wednesday's game, I believe that happened in, but then it like came back later in the game. So I don't know. It's one of those conspiracy theory things.
I think we can conclude it's a perfect system. No notes. We've been talking to Steve Drumright from Pitcher List and Brewer Fanatic. Steve, thanks so much for joining us on Hitting Season.
Appreciate it, Justin. Looking forward to a good series.
That'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. My thanks to my co-host Liz Rocher and my guest Steve Drumright. You can get new episodes of Hittin' Season 3 times a week anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also find bonus Phillies podcasts at the Hittin' Season Patreon at patreon.com/hittinseason. I'm Justin Clue, and from WHYY, that's the ballgame. We'll talk to you next time on Hittin' Season.